Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Hello. We're continuing our study in 2 Samuel. I hope you'll get your Bibles and turn to chapter 18. We're continuing in the problems caused by Absalom's rebellion. So I hope you'll follow with me in your text. Then David numbered the people. The idea here is organized, not just counted them, but organized them, who were with him. And Josephus says there were 4,000 soldiers with David. Of course, we're in the Transjordan area, the area of Gilead, somewhere close to the capital of Ish-bosheth's territory. And he set over them commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. We must remember this is a very ancient military organization going back to the time of the Exodus, Exodus 18:21, Deuteronomy 1:15. And one of the problems in numbering in the Old Testament is that it seems that the word thousand can refer to a military unit or a tribal group, like a clan, and not literally the number thousand. So sometimes we're not really sure, like later it's going to be 20,000 of Israel killed. Again, we're not sure if that meant 20,000 individuals or a certain number, 20 of these military units. We just can't be sure on that. And David sent people out, one-third under the command of Joab. Now, that's, of course, his relative, the son of Jesse's sister. And he has been the military commander all along, a very high-strung individual. He has disobeyed David before in killing of Abner and on, but still a very trusted, a very capable military man. And one-third under the command of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah. And, of course, that is Joab's brother. Another very gifted military man. And then one-third under Ittai the Gittite. And the Gittite, of course, we think means Gath. This apparently was one of the mercenary groups that was with David. This apparently was a Philistine from Gath, a foreigner. We're not exactly sure, but obviously he had tremendous military skills, and David placed him over a third also. Let's see. We might want to see the friendship that's expressed by this man to David, the loyalty, back in chapter 15, verses 18 through 23. And the king said to the people, I myself will surely go out and with you also. This was expected of the king. This is where David got in trouble back with Bathsheba and not going with the army. But we're not sure exactly how old is David here. And the army is going to say, no, we need you here. If they kill you, this whole campaign is over. You're important to us. Stay back here. You'll be more help in the rear of the army than in the front this time. And David is going to listen to that. The people said, you should not go out, for if we indeed flee, they will not care about us. Now, this might have come from the spy network that David had. It was Ahithophel's plan that they kill only David, that the military units strike for David alone. Maybe that's why they're telling David, stay back now. They're looking for you and you alone. So stay back at the city. Help us from the city. And, of course, the city is Mahanaim, which is Ish-bosheth's capital. And the king said to them, whatever seems best to you, I will do. And the king stood beside the gate. Now, this standing beside the gate, standing between the gates, standing over the gates, it's very hard for us today to understand how these gates were structured. Many of them were like a tower. There was a little room inside the gate. You could be up high. You could be down low. And sometimes it's very difficult to know. Some say beside the gate here was a special position up on the wall where he'd kind of review the troops, see them coming in and out. We're just not exactly sure what it means there beside the gate. And all the people went out by hundreds and thousands, their military units. And David charged Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. Well, isn't this amazing? David still has great compassion for his son, even though his son has had such a difficult time with his father growing up. The relationship began to go sour with his killing of Amnon. This rebellion seems to him taking the concubines of David. Everything pointed there should be great animosity, but I think in David's heart, David knew that this was because of his own sexual sin and the prophecy of Nathan, and this young man, his son, his third oldest, the other two apparently have died, is caught up in this prophecy of judgment. And he asked these military commanders to spare his life, what he's doing. And all the people heard the king, charge that. So all this army knew that David still had a great care. Now, that's not a real easy thing to go out and fight somebody who the king still loves. That kind of makes it a bit tentative. Verse 6. Then the people went out into the field against Israel, because most of these troops were from the Israel, the allocation. And the battle took place in the forest of Ephraim. That seems to be very strange to us. It is obvious, it says, they crossed over Jordan, which implies they crossed them to the eastern bank of Jordan. But the tribal allocation of Ephraim is back on the western side of Jordan. Now, it's true that part of the family of Joseph, of Manasseh, another one of the sons of Joseph, as Ephraim is on the west bank. Some go back to Judges chapter 12 and say that Ephraim claimed some of the land on the east bank. Now, others say some settlers from Ephraim settled in this area. The truth is, we're not sure of the location, but it was a forest, and it was apparently a very difficult terrain. A lot of pits and holes and gullies. A dangerous place. Now, apparently, David had much fewer men, but these men were highly trained and organized and veteran soldiers. Absalom had a large army, but kind of the home militia, not trained well, not organized well, not used to fighting. And therefore, in a forest, the numbers would not be helpful, because small military units would attack this small unit, and others would not know where to come to their aid. Now, and the people of Israel were defeated there before the servants of David, and the slaughter that day was great, 20,000 men. Now again, we're not sure it's a literal 20,000 or if it's 20 of these military units. We just can't be sure. For the battle was spread over the whole countryside, meaning it didn't matter how many troops you had, it was only small groups spread out. And here are three things that caused these men to die. Number one, the forest devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. Now, what does that mean? Number one, in the thick of the battle, in the forest where no one could see, some of these military units deserted, went back to their homes. Number two, it could mean that many of them fell into these pits or holes or fell off into these caverns, and the forest itself killed them. There may be some theological implication there, nature fighting on behalf of David, much as happened during the period of Joshua's conquest, where hornets or hail or the sun would be an ally of God's people. And then thirdly, it may mean that they lost their military unit. They just got lost of where they were supposed to be. They were supposed to be in the flank of so-and-so, but they lost so-and-so, didn't know where to be, and so they got confused. Now, one of those is what it means, but which one, I'm not sure. Now, Absalom seemed to meet the servants of David, happened to meet the servants of David, for Absalom was riding his mule. And again, I want to say this mule was a special amount of royalty. And the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak. Now, it may be tinnabith or oak, we're just not sure. And his head caught fast in the oak. Now, there seems to be a play on this. In earlier chapters, there was much made out of Absalom's hair. It's so long and thick, and everybody praised it. There was a lot made of his height. He was a tall man. Now, it seems that what happened is his height combined with his long hair and him being in a hurry, apparently retreating, the tradition is his hair, these long black locks of hair got caught in the tree. That is said by the Talmud, the Jewish Talmud, and also Josephus. But if you look at the text clearly, it doesn't say his hair was caught in the branches. It said his head was caught in the branches. Some theorize that what happened is that he somehow got his head or neck wedged in the fork of a tree. And it wasn't so much his hair as his head or neck. And I think the text implies that. He's hanging there between heaven and earth while his mule went out from under him. Now, when a certain man saw it, he told Joab and said, "Behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak." And Joab said to the man who told him, "Now behold, you saw him? Why did you not strike him there to the ground? And I would have given you 10 pieces of silver and a belt." Now, there's some ambiguity in the Hebrew here. There's ambiguity in the amount of money that Joab promised. The Masoretic text has 10, but the Dead Sea Scrolls of 2 Samuel, and also Josephus' account, the Antiquities of the Jews, has 50 silver pieces. Now, it's not coinage. It's still weight of metal. Sometimes it's called a shekel, but you must remember, not a coin shekel, but a weight. And the other implication is this kind of a, by the way, the word belt here is some kind of military girdle of honor. Maybe the heavyweight champion of the world in boxing belt might be a cultural symbol, much like that. I'd have given you a belt of honor in the military. Is this implying that Joab had told his men that the one who kills Absalom, he'd reward? That sounds funny in light of David's statement that was well known among the troops. Is Joab saying, why don't you go kill him, friend, and I'll give this to you, implying, let his blood be on your head and not mine? Is there a veiled kind of thing here? I'm not sure. Now, the man said to Joab, even if I should receive 1,000 pieces of silver in my hand, I would not put out my hand against the king's son. For in the hearing, the king charged you and Abishai and Ittai, saying, protect me for me, the young man Absalom. The man just is very bold and tells Joab he shouldn't be doing this. Otherwise, if I had dealt treacherously against his life, and there is nothing hidden from the king. Now, verse 13, that little princess, that's interesting to me. David must have had a great spy network. We see something of the way the network operated in chapter 17, where he even knew what Absalom was planning and even sent false counselors back into the situation. So David must have really had a network of people who told him what was happening. This is an allusion to that in verse 13. Then you yourself would have stood aloof. What he's saying to him is, if I kill Absalom and David gets mad at me, you'd just kind of stand out of the way like you had nothing to do with it. And Joab says, get out of my way. I'll go do it myself. Let's see. So Joab said, I will not waste time here with you. So he took 3 spears. Now, there's some ambiguity here about the Hebrew word. Some say it's sticks. Some say it's rods. Some say it's spikes or arrows or something like that. And thrust them through the heart of Absalom. Why 3? He wanted to be sure he was killed. It was a factor of intensity. I'm just not sure. And while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. Now, I think that, of course, Absalom kills him here with these 3 spears through his heart. But look at verse 15. 10 young men who carried Joab's armor gathered around and struck Absalom and killed him. Now, why would that be? They didn't want Joab to take the blame by himself. And so if all of them struck him, they would kind of share the blame, take it off their commander, and that seems to be what's happening here. So Joab blew the trumpet. Now, of course, the trumpet was a means of communicating with troops in battle. And the people returned from pursuing Israel, for Joab restrained the people. Now, this seems to be an act of mercy on Joab's part, that he didn't want to kill the other Jewish brothers. Once they killed Absalom, the revolt was over. The same way that they said once they killed David, the revolt would be over. And so here it comes to true in his life. And they took Absalom and cast him into... Now, my New American Standard in verse 17 has a great pit or a deep pit. But the Hebrew has the definite article here, the great pit. Some have assumed that this was a mass burial plot for all of the people of Israel that fell that day. You can't get that from the text, except it's implied in that article there. In the forest, and erected over him a great heap of stones, and all Israel fled, each to his tent. This great heap of stone is interesting. This seems to be the way of burying someone in great reproach. Remember back in Joshua chapter 7, verse 26, where they bury Achan with a pile of stones. And remember in Joshua chapter 8, verse 29, and Joshua chapter 10, verse 27, this is the way they buried the defeated kings. So some say it's a way of showing disrespect. Others say it's kind of a play. Look at verse 18. It's a play on what Absalom had done. He had set up for himself a pillar in the king's valley. Now, this setting up for yourself a pillar while you're still alive was an act of arrogance and pride. The pillar was said to be because he had no children. That contradicts some other passages we have in 2 Samuel, though it seems to imply his sons must have died very early. His daughter is named, his sons aren't. That's highly unusual. So he set up this thing in the king's valley. Now, where is the king's valley? Well, from Genesis 14:17, it seems to be somewhere near Sodom and Gomorrah. From other passages, it seems to be near Jerusalem. The truth is, we really don't know. For he said, I have no son to preserve my name. You might want to see chapter 14, verse 27. This is an irony here. He raised up a pillar to be remembered by, and this is kind of a mock pillar. This huge pile of stone is a mock pillar of, here's in sarcasm, this man liked pillars for his own self. We'll just raise him up another pillar, his death pillar. And that seems to be kind of the play on this. Then one of the sons of Zadok is mentioned in verse 19. He's one of the spy networks of David that brought news about the plans of Absalom. He wants to run and take news to David that the revolt is over. But apparently Joab was reluctant to that. Somehow, the kind of messenger you send reflects the type of message he carries. If this young son of Zadok had gone, David would have thought it was good news. But he wants a foreigner to take it, so David will know it's bad news. Kind of get prepared a little bit. And he says, no, son, not on this one. In verse 20 he says, you're not the man to carry it this day. And then he asks one of the other apparently mercenaries, and this man is a Cushite, an Ethiopian, who was a part of this mercenary band that David had. And apparently these were his loyal personal troops that were with him from his wilderness wandering days in the Philistine area and all of that time there. He sent the Cushite to tell. But the young son of Zadok kept saying, oh, Joab, please let me go. And the other man was gone a long ways, and Joab thought he couldn't catch up with him. He said, okay, go ahead. But apparently they took different routes. We're not certain of that from the text, but it seems to be that. And the young son of Zadok outran the other man. In verse 24 through 27, we see the watchman on the wall saying, here comes a runner by himself. That means good news. Now, apparently that means if a lot of men had been running toward the city, it would have meant that the army had been routed and was running for safety. But one man probably meant good news. And then another man comes running, and apparently this man was a well-known for his speed or had a unique kind of a running style. For they seem to say, it seems like it's Zadok's son, in verse 27, and it was. So Zadok's son got there first, and he was a little afraid to tell the king. The king asked him, and he said, well, the rebellion's over, but he didn't mention that Absalom had been killed. When the Cushite got there, he mentioned very forcibly and plainly that Absalom was dead. Listen to what David says. The king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And thus he said as he walked, oh, my son, Absalom, my son, Absalom, would I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. Oh, the repetition of the word son. The repetition of Absalom's name, the phrase, I would have died for you. David recognized his own sin had turned to his own family. Now his children were paying the price that he should have paid. It's one of the saddest verses in all the Bible. Got real people here reaping the consequences of their sin against Yahweh. Chapter 19. Then it was told Joab, behold, the king is weeping and mourns for Absalom. And the victory that day was turned to mourning for all the people. For the people heard it and said that day, the king is grieved for his son. That may seem natural to you, but this was a rebel about to take over the kingdom, about to kill all these people, including David. So the people went by stealth into the city that day, as people who are humiliated steal away when they flee in a battle. David had turned the joyful victory into a sad humiliation because of the way he acted. Instead of the greeting the troops and thanking them and praising them and showing his response for their loyalty and their prowess in battle, he was up in the roof chamber of the gate because of his own personal grief, up there for his own personal reasons. Now, Joab came into the house of David and said, today you have covered with shame the faces of all your servants, military men, who today have saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives and the lives of your concubines, by loving those who hate you and hating those who love you. What does it mean by that? Absalom hated you. Absalom was trying to kill you. He planned to kill you. He plotted to kill you. And yet you're showing grief over a man like this. And the very people who's put their life on the line for you, you're acting in a shameful, disrespectful way. Whoa, it's strong words here. For you have shown today that princes and servants are nothing to you. You've shown that your military people don't mean anything to you. You're more concerned about your own personal affairs than you are your own army that protects you and fights your battles. For I know this day that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, then you would be pleased. Woo! It's like slapping this king right in the face saying this kind of thing to him. You don't think it was true? Shows where David's priority was. Showed where he wasn't really caring about God's people. He wasn't caring about the nation of Israel. He was all caught up in his personal family problems. Now, therefore, arise and go out and speak kindly to your servant. This word, speak kindly, means speak to their speak to the heart. The word heart here used in the sense of the seat of the emotions. Speak kindly to your servants. For I swear by Yahweh, notice there's all caps there. This is the covenant name for God from the Hebrew verb to be, Exodus 3:14. This is the idea of I swear in God's name. Very strong oath. If you do not go out, surely not a man will pass the night with you. Now, I think there's a veiled threat here. I think Joab is saying, David, you've won the day against Absalom, but the way you're acting is so disrespectful to your army that I swear to God, if you don't change the way you're acting, they're going to leave and I'm going to take them. It's a veiled kind of reference that I'm going to revolt against you and I'm going to take your own army with me. We learn later on that's exactly what he did. When David's next son, Adonijah, rebels, Joab will be his military commander. Now, it's hard to read psychological things in here. It sounds Joab had been the very man that got David to bring Absalom out of hiding. Joab seemed to be a unique friend of Absalom and support him. After Absalom burned his field and kind of threatened Joab, Joab's mind changed. Joab's the very one that kills him now. But it seems to be through here. The way Joab does not obey David's commands, he apparently loves David, but he has his own personal interest in mind. And this may be a veiled reference of that right here about, I swear by Yahweh, if you do not stop this and go out and speak to your troops, not a one of them will be left. Implication, and I'll lead them away myself. And this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your youth until now. Well, Joab kind of tells David, you think it's been bad in your life, being run off by Saul, having to live with the Philistines, having to be a robber. Now you've been run out of Jerusalem by your own son. It's nothing to compare what's going to happen to you if your army leaves you. Now, probably he's not referring to this these elite foreign mercenaries, but he is referring to the other part of the army, the Judeans that stayed with David. I don't think David's mercenary troop would have left him, but Joab was going to take some with him. So the king rose and sat in the gate. Now, what does this mean, he sat in the gate? Again, I think there must have been a structure somewhere up on the wall where the by the gate where you could see outside and inside. Now, did the king address them, the men here? There is no record of him saying anything to the troops. Thank you, good job, nothing. But maybe just him being in the gate, the place they expect the king to be when the army goes in and out. Remember, he's in the same place when they left. Maybe they say things are back to normal. David's got over his grief. So we're not sure if he said something because the next, the latter part of verse 8 really should go with the next passage. But it's things are back to normal, and I'm assuming David said something to them. Thank you, brothers, men, loyal ones. Thank you for saving my life, for saving the people of God, for not killing all the Israel people. Remember how they let them go to their own tents? Of course, there were no tents. This is kind of a metaphor from back in the wilderness wandering days. But it was a metaphor they enjoyed. You let your brothers go home. So I think that's what it implies here, though it's not recorded. And behold, the king is sitting in the gate. Then all the people came before the king. Seems to have been a general meeting, and the words are just not recorded. Well, this is going to close out this section tonight. We're going to be dealing with the rest of this context, the rest of chapter 19 and chapter 20 in our next lesson. I think this is an extremely interesting account. It does show you the charisma of David, but charisma was not enough. David had to act appropriately. I mean, the people expected the king to do certain things, and even if David didn't do that, he was in jeopardy. And I think it's amazing to me, David's love for his son. And yet, I just know David felt guilt about what he'd caused in his own family. I think you can see that here. Joab is a man we're going to reckon with later again. He's just a man who's pretty headstrong. He's going to do what he thinks is right no matter what. He's going to kill David's son no matter what David wants because he believes the man's a threat to the kingdom. And then he's going to walk in and just slap David in the face verbally about how he's acting. He was a relative of David. I think in many ways he was a competitor. I think in many ways he was a good friend. And somehow all rolled together. Well, now David's first three sons have died. Throughout this problem with succession, David had already stated that Solomon was going to be his successor. But he didn't inform the people. He didn't push that point. He didn't announce that point. And because of that, there's all this jealousy and strife among his sons, as Nathan said there would. Here's a man of God with major family problems. Just because you love God doesn't mean you're a good father. Well, I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.